Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Boahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge. Currently serving as CEO. Under his leadership, Tata Technologies has emerged as a global engineering services powerhouse, helping organizations design, develop, and deliver innovative solutions in the automotive, aerospace, and industrial sectors. Ward's career spans decades of operational and executive excellence, with a keen focus on developing talent and ensuring quality across every project. He has also served on the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Awards Board of Overseers, further cementing his commitment to performance and organizational excellence. Today, we'll delve into Warren's leadership insights, his approach to staying ahead of the pace in an industry that is constantly transforming. Welcome, Warren.
Thank you. Thank you ever so much.
We're delighted to have you. And before we delve into your expertise, we're going to pause for a moment, Warren, because we believe at the Employee Wellbeing Council of focusing on remaining human-centric in this age, in the age of AI, as we oftentimes say. And so we have determined you're a human, so we are going to center you initially. And the way in which we do that, Warren, is we ask you a Proust-inspired question from the Proust questionnaire. Marcel Proust was an essayist, as you may know, and he used to use these questions in his parlor games because he felt that the answers to these questions would enlighten us on your true nature. So are you ready for your question, Warren?
I am ready for my question. I'm somewhat intimidated, but I'm ready for my question.
That's very kind of you to say, though I'm not sure I believe it. What is your most treasured possession, Warren?
My most treasured possession. I'm from the northwest of England, and I grew up with a passion for my local football team. In Liverpool, there's two teams. There's Everton and Liverpool. And my dad was a big Everton fan, and so from the age of four, I went to what is now a very old stadium in Liverpool. And one of my big heroes while I was growing up was a center forward called Duncan Ferguson. And for my 50th birthday, my kids somehow managed to get a shirt of Duncan Ferguson, and he signed it to Warren. And that is hung in my gym. So that is, I think, my most prized possession. I have four children. They are obviously my number one priority, and I have a large extended family, so they count too. But in terms of possessions, that's my favorite.
Amazing, because it really is not just about the object, it is the history behind the object.
Absolutely.
Right? Telling the story and probably brings back memories of your trips with your father, right? Going to the matches and spending my time with him. And so that's why I think it's such a brilliant question in some ways. So it behooves me, as I'm sitting across from you technically, to ask you some strategy questions. You're top of the game in a CEO. In a sector, not only tech, but also servicing sectors like automotive and manufacturing that are constantly in a state of transformation. So, you know, my question really is what does the future of AI look like? And I have my notes next 2 to 5 years, but I think that's like long range planning. I think what does the future look like the next year or two, right? At the speed at which AI is being also developed.
Yeah, it's a great question, and you know, AI is transforming, I think every sector now, and specifically the sectors in which we are in. You know, there's a fundamental inflection point that I think that we are going through. You know, the automotive industry, which we provide services to, is really going through a once in a century transformation and change, and the changes are essentially being driven around the vectors of electrification, the move to connected and the move to autonomous driving. Mm-hmm. And AI is having a fundamental impact upon the accelerated transition to the way in which mobility will operate in the future. And there's a lot of buzz around our industry around things like software-defined vehicles. But in many respects, even though we've only been grappling with software-defined vehicles for 5 or 6 years, you know, that's a legacy view of the industry, in that software used to provide functionality and capabilities, but we would need an army of software engineers to develop those capabilities and deploy it on vehicles. With AI, what we're having now is the ability to be able to learn and not rely upon the rule-based solutions that were driven by software engineers in the past. And again, that's opening up enormous opportunities for safety solutions, driver and passenger experience solutions, and the whole way in which vehicles and mobility solutions are manufactured and designed. So it's a very exciting time in our industry, and you know, for those of us that have been around for a long time, you know, we've been waiting for these types of changes for what seems like forever. But you know, we are really seeing now the advent of autonomous driving. We're really seeing the connection of vehicles with all smart products, and again, the opportunities that represents are very exciting indeed.
Sure, I mean, including accessibility. I mean, when you think about people as they age, and we always, with our parents at one point in time, say, should they be driving anymore, right? They may still be able to go out. And I mean, there's some really positive things. I saw my first driverless car in San Francisco this summer. And I have to say that I was a little bit freaked out. Moving with no driver, but I mean, that is the road of the future. Will the mechanic be now behind a computer, Warren?
Well, you know, you just to pick up on your comment about autonomous solutions, you know, there's still, you know, almost a there's just over 1 million people a year that are killed on the roads around the world, and I think the opportunity that AI and software has to prevent the type of issues that have informed that type of statistic, I think it's really exciting indeed. You know, there's a lot of hype that is surrounding the improved experience that we're likely to have in mobility. But you know, I think to the point that you make, you know, one of the most exciting things for me is the fact that we are likely to be safer. We're likely to be delivering solutions that are better for the planet, and we're likely to be able to provide opportunities, you know, for those individuals that perhaps in the past have not been able to get around. And you referenced the elderly, but I think it's you know, it's just as it's going to be just as impactful for those that have disabilities and have previously not been able to get around without help.
Sure, and I love sort of the idea or the vision that perhaps one day we won't need MAD anymore, right? The organization Mothers Against Drunk Driving, because that will just it will be wiped out. That would be
exactly. Great.
Yeah,
absolutely. Great point.
So as a CEO, as I've mentioned, I think every time I feel like I should always say Mr. CEO Warren Harris. what are the biggest challenges that you think CEOs are going to face in leading companies, though, through these AI-driven changes?
You know, I think the biggest change, and this is true for companies like ourselves, but it's also true for our customers, is the issues related to organizational change. You know, the technology is increasingly providing options for how we run companies better, for the services and solutions that we look to generate value around. And I think that the appetite that most organizations have got for change is not matching the clock speed of how technology is evolving. And so, you know, from my perspective, the biggest challenge is a human factors challenge. It's right. It's about how do we ready companies for the impact of technology? How do we ensure that our cultures are agile? How do we encourage our teams to be constantly learning and acknowledging that that there is a real need for investment in oneself in order to be relevant and meaningful going forward? And I think that's the bigger challenge. I think the tangible impact of technology is relatively easy to understand, and I think the applicability of AI solutions across almost every function is something that that I think has been well documented. But those organizations that that demonstrate their ability to be able to move quickly and to pivot, I think those organizations are going to be the ones that are successful in the future.
Right. And the pivoting and that change, though, really requires bringing, from what I hear you say, the people on board, not only upskilling, reskilling, but also from an attitudinal perspective. And we, you know that in tech projects, oftentimes that change management piece around people is probably the toughest piece, right? You can figure out the technical aspects, but how do you then also bring everybody along, upskill, reskill, and just have the, I would say, attitudinal perspective, the right attitude towards this development. That's the one aspect. The other aspect that I sometimes worry about and I write about a bit is also the readiness of the organization to bring in the technology and look at it in a wholesome fashion. So mm-hmm. I worry sometimes by bringing in these efficient technologies that we also don't pause and reflect on the other changes that need to happen because they are interdependencies and that we lose sight of the people. Right. That so not only do the people need to be ready, but we as organizations also need to remember to make sure that the people remain focused.
I think it's a really great point. And that's why I characterize it not as a people change management issue, but an organizational change management issue. And I think we need to look at increasingly, you know, organizations as systems and look at the value chains and the work that we need to do in order to ensure that not only do we message but we facilitate and we nudge and we encourage the type of change and again agility and flexibility that I think is going to be increasingly important.
Right. Yeah, it's funny that you said systems because I've been called a rather overly academic paper on systems thinking, use of systems thinking and organizational development, but I stand by it. So let's, you know, we'll move more into leadership and I want to talk a little bit about ethics in a moment, but I also just want to maybe ask you one more strategy question as it develops, as it relates to the influence on your company's strategic decisions as you're developing your products in terms, you know, whether the future of mobility, for example. How does AI influence your company's strategic decisions in shaping the future of mobility?
Well, I think AI is a subset of the technologies that that will increasingly impact the industry verticals that we support, and so it's a constant and a pervasive input to all of the strategic decisions that we make. You know, how do we organize ourselves? You know, traditionally, we've had a relatively standard organization. You know, we've had business development teams, we've had practice teams, we've had delivery teams, we have the back office functions, and we typically build value chains around those conventional capabilities. And I think AI has the ability to be able to disrupt and prompt us to look at things in a completely different way. So, you know, clearly there's going to be disruption in terms of the lines of service that that we embrace and the value that we deliver to our customers. And so we're looking at AI in the context of that. But we're also looking at AI in the context, again, of how do we organize ourselves? How do we manage culture? You know, how do we manage engagement? How do we touch people more effectively? How do we bring people into the decision making? How do we become much more inclusive? We're an organization of 13,000 people. We are managed out of 18 different geographic locations. There's 35 different nationalities inside of our organization. And so, you know, one of the challenges that we have been grappling with is how do we bring people together? How do we bring people of difference together, you know, towards the common vision and the plan that we've got for the company? And we're certainly looking at how does technology inform our ability to do that?
Right. And so, as you said, it's so pervasive in lines of business or in general. What are the ethical considerations that are top of mind as we're in this age as well?
Well, I think, you know, for us, you know, we are part of the Tata Group. The Tata Group is India's oldest business house. But one of the things that's not well known is that the group is 2/3 owned by a charitable trust, and the value system that underpins the group is very much swayed towards ethics and doing the right thing and giving back to the communities in which we live and work. And so ethics is another pervasive issue against which we make all of our decisions, and it's something that you know, we hire to, we manage behavior around, we promote people around. And so when we look at the use of technology, you know, we look at, again, how does that relate to what we stand for, and how does it inform our ability to be able to practice what's important to us? And so, you know, things, you know, such as the, you know, large language models that that we will we are leveraging. We want to make sure that that the learnings of those large language models are consistent with what we believe are the things that that we want to be associated with. When we are leveraging AI to generate things like software, we want to make sure that the software that we are building is software that that does not encroach upon the IP of another organization. And so, you know, for us, there is a series of policies that we are deploying that that will guide the use of technology and specifically AI to ensure that it it continues to position our organization in a way, again, that's consistent with the expectations of our group, but also is consistent to the way in which we've run the company, you know, in the past when we've not had the technology tools that are currently available to us.
And so I read, as I did a little bit of research, I mean, there's the mantra at the Tata of engineering a better world for all. So that's probably the baseline upon which you're making your decisions as well.
Well, and that's right. You know, and for us, you know, that means a couple of different things. You know, engineering a better world is about developing safer, cleaner products for the customers that we work with. But it also means, again, you know, bringing people together that are different towards a common goal. And at a time when the world is increasingly divided, you know, I think that that's a very small example of what good looks like when again, people come together. But it's, you know, for us, engineering a better world is about, again, being an example to others in terms of doing the right thing. And so whenever we make technology decisions, whenever we make decisions in terms of the way in which we enable business, the way in which we drive productivity, you know, it's always decisions that are made through a lens of how does this align with the values that are important to us? How does this reinforce the behaviors that are consistent with the type of company that we want to be?
It must actually be quite lovely to be a leader in such an environment, Ward.
It really is. I came into the Tata Group through acquisition. I had just taken a company public in London. We had a very successful IPO, and then along came Mr. Tata and suggested that we should take what we had built in Europe and in North America and put that together with capacity and capability that the group had in India. And I was not expecting, as an entrepreneur, I was not expecting to stick around in this big corporation. But I had the privilege of meeting Mr. Tata at the in the Georges V Hotel in Paris in 2005, and he entertained me for dinner, and spent 3-4 hours talking about the values of the group. The purpose of the organization, and how he wanted the group to evolve in the future, and I was so struck by the value system and the potential that India represents for delivering not only value to the rest of the world, but also what India represents in terms of an example to the rest of the world. I was so struck by that that I've dedicated the last 20 years of my career to being a part of it, and I am continue to be very very privileged and very humbled by the opportunity that I've been given.
Amazing and very enthusiastic, and you know the phrase that you just can't quit them and they can't quit you, obviously. And so let's talk a little bit further on leadership, Warren. In this age, and you know, very clear that there's a strong value system that's carried through Tata for decades, for 120 years. As we come into this age, though, of AI, and maybe there are changes or maybe there aren't, I'm just curious, what do you think about leadership qualities? Is there something that's different now that leaders need to possess as a competency, as a quality, as they guide their teams through these new transformations or this pivotal age?
I'm not sure that technology changes what's required of a leader. You know, at the end of the day, a leader, by definition, can only perform if they have followers, and I think there's a number of things that inform your ability to influence and inspire people to follow. You know, one I think is experience and capability. I think one has to have a track record that will command the respect of smart people. I think that there is an expectation today that leaders are behaving in the right way. You know, I think that there is again. You know, respect that one needs to attract, not just by what you've done, but by how you've done it. So I think that's important, and I think particularly in the context of our organization, you know, things like diversity and inclusion is so important. I referenced before the fact that we have 35 different nationalities. You know, we have 50% of our leadership team that are women. You know, we've invested a great deal of time and effort to provide a platform for everybody. You know, there is not because we're an Indian company by ownership. You know, we do not exclude Chinese people to work for us, Eastern European people to work for us. And so, you know, we've worked hard to build that type of culture. And I reference that because I think that creating that environment is again another another important aspect of leadership. And leadership is, to my mind, it's all about delivering success to others. And so if you can create an environment that provides an opportunity, you know, for people to be successful, then I think that one is fulfilling the responsibility that you have. And technology can enable many of those things, but I think that the fundamentals are not defined by technology. They're much more about the connection that we have between each other.
Right. And so there's two things that struck me. I actually just yesterday referenced that phrase as well. If you're, you know, you can't be a leader if nobody's following you, right? If you're a leader, you think you're leading and you look back and nobody's following you, you're not doing such a great job. And the other piece that I think you really ascribed to then in the last little bit of your statement was delivering success to others. It's a form of servant leadership. So you're an ascriber to servant leadership then, Warren.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's, for me, and I learned this from spending a little bit of time with Pat Lencioni on the West Coast and his team at the Table Group. You know, he shared with me that there's two types of leader. You know, there's one that sees the role of leadership as almost a prize to be won, mm-hmm. and once you achieve that prize, you know, there is an expectation of that type of leader that some of the spoils of success, you know, should come with the winning of the race, as it were. You know, whereas, you know, for me, you know, leadership is very much a profound responsibility. Mm-hmm. It's a profound responsibility for others, and to your point, you know, I think that it represents an act of service, and for me, if I'm not serving the organization, if I'm not serving my direct reports, if I'm not serving my employees, then I'm not fulfilling the responsibility and the role that has been assigned to me.
I really appreciate the way you've outlined that for us. It's a privilege. Leadership is a privilege. So as we come towards the end of our discussion here, Warren, we would like you to offer some practical advice. Is there a website, a book, an article, or learning that a leader could access today to continue their leadership journey? Is there something that comes to mind to you?
Yeah, there is. You know, there's. I've referenced Pat Lencioni, and I've devoured everything that he's ever published and he's ever written. Starting with the five dysfunctions of a team that he published in the late 80s, early
90s. Exactly.
Yeah, but you know, there's a book that he wrote about 10 years ago called Organizational Health. And he positions in that book that organizational health is dependent upon four things. That one, an aligned leadership team. So he spends a lot of time talking about how does one create a leadership team that is aligned in terms of the priorities that the company has, and aligned in terms of how it represents that to the rest of the company that they are responsible for. So he positions that. Then he positions the importance of clarity and alignment around six basic questions. You know, why do we exist? How do we behave? What is it we do? What does success look like? What's important right now? And who does what? Mm-hmm. And I think you'd be surprised if you were to canvas opinion from many organizations how diverse the answers to those six basic questions are. And I know through practice that by reinforcing clarity around those six basic questions, it really does ensure that the alignment as you cascade responsibility and empowerment throughout an organization, how that represents a multiplier effect in terms of performance. So he talks about those two things. Then he talks about the importance of over communicating, mm-hmm. and reinforcing the answers to those six basic questions, and also the priorities that surround an organization. And then once you've taken the responsibility for over communicating, then institutionalizing clarity in terms of, you know, how do you celebrate success? How do you hire? How do you manage performance? How do you promote? So that the things that you say are reinforced by the actions that the organization commits themselves to. So it's a great book. It's a fun read, but it has some very profound lessons, I think, for leaders, not just CEOs or C-level execs, but anybody that's leading a team.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it sounds, even those questions alone, if you would ask within a team after a meeting, what is your answer to each of these questions? Probably in a team meeting, you would get, you know, a multitude of answers.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say that when I first tested this with my leadership team, and I think at the time I had about 12 different people, and I asked them anonymously to answer the questions. And I got 12 different answers to the 6 questions.
Yes, right. So you couldn't get better data than that. that you needed to start over communicating clearly and ensuring that right everybody was aligned. That sounds like a perfect book.
That over communication. He tells a joke in the book about the husband and the wife, and the wife says to the husband, you know, why don't you tell me you love me? And the husband says that. I did on the day we were married, and if anything changes, I'll let you know. And that, and as companies, we are so guilty of that.
Yes.
You know, we hate redundancy. Once we communicate something, we feel as though it's been understood and everybody's on board. And of course, that's never the case.
Never the case. So I'm just going to repeat, it's Pat Lencioni, and the book is called Organizational Health.
That's right. Yes.
Lovely. So to close, Warren, if you could give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
That's a great question. I think the advice that I would probably give is the importance of networking. I've been very privileged to be helped by so many different people in my career. You know, there are so many people that have given me a hand up and offered advice and support and gone out of their way to facilitate opportunities for me. And I've learned the benefit of that almost later in my career. I was very fortunate in the early part of my career to come across individuals that saw something in me that that they encouraged and supported. And towards the end of my career, I'd been much more deliberate about reaching out and asking for help. And so I think if I was to give my younger self some advice, it would be to reach out much earlier and to leverage the support of others, because if you do that, you'll find that typically people are well intentioned and they're really willing to offer support and to help.
That's a great piece of advice. Thanks so much. So, on behalf of the Employee Wellbeing Council, Warren, I'd like to thank you a lot for your generosity of spirit and insight, and I've just really enjoyed our conversation this afternoon.
You and me both. Thank you ever so much. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well and lead with purpose.